when I think about kind of like what defines me, I think it's a lot about how you take what you learn in one stage of life and apply it to the next. And then also how you use what you're, you know, the skills that you have and the experience you have to go and empower and support others. But I think that's a lot of the, you know, the essence of why I'm doing what I'm doing and why I'm so excited to wake up and work on Vinebase every day as well.
Welcome to the Abwazi Wine Buzz podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clinton Lee. Today's guest is an entrepreneur. Not only has she achieved an enormous amount of accolades, experience within the technological world, but she's harnessed that as one would like take a beam of light, laser focus, and is now focused onto the world of wine. Today's guest is Rachel Woods, who is the CEO, founder of Vinebase. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk today.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. Now, there's so much about you, Rachel, that I didn't want to take it all in the introduction. So tell us about yourself, Rachel, so that guests can know more about you.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd love to. So a little bit about me, I guess, first off, I was born and raised in Austin, Texas, you know, had a really amazing kind of exposure to tech early on from the fact that Austin is, you know, back in the day when I was growing up, it was already a tech scene. Now it's definitely a burgeoning tech scene. But really from that, got a lot of exposure to kind of how, you know, you could start in one side of tech and really learn about and get exposure to a different side of tech, a different application, and kind of that entire like evolving career journey, if you will. So a lot of people don't know, I actually started out in marketing. That was my first kind of love within tech. And starting in marketing, I, you know, really loved the creative side, but then basically saw that if I taught myself to code, I could do like kind of even cooler marketing things. And that ended up being a little bit of a snowball effect into learning more and more about coding, getting more and more into that side of tech. And then I ended up moving out to the Bay Area and working at Facebook as a data scientist in ads, which was kind of this amazing blend of, you know, the marketing and technical side of the tech world. And from that, I spent a lot of time focusing on like small business tools and how you could, you know, take the power of Facebook ads or similar platforms within tech and really make that accessible to a broader audience of businesses and people in a community. And so when I think about kind of like what defines me, I think it's a lot about how you take what you learn in one stage of life and apply it to the next. And then also how you use what you're, you know, the skills that you have and the experience you have to go and empower and support others. And I won't kind of like dive too far into what we're doing into wine yet, because we have the whole conversation ahead of us. But I think that's a lot of the, you know, the essence of why I'm doing what I'm doing and why I'm so excited to wake up and work on Vinebase every day as well.
Well, that's wonderful. Now you have a very bright background right now. Whereabouts are you, Rachel?
I am actually in LA right now. So I'm spending the month in a female founder residency, which is 20 people came together this month. We're living this huge house in Beverly Hills, and just kind of collaborating and working all together. It's been really awesome. I'm the only wine company here. And so it's been really fun to bring out all the amazing like producers that we work with, and have some people come to the house as well.
So really like a hive of ingenuity and innovativeness coming out of all your conversations and interactions with your fellow participants. That must be a spectacular experience. You'll have to tell us about that later.
Yeah, definitely.
Afterwards. Yes. Now, Rachel, as you mentioned, you're the only wine company there. Now, your career has not been focused on wine. It has been more on technology, analytical, photographic, marketing spheres. So how did you decide upon wine being the focus?
Yeah, so you definitely caught my first business in your research was that when I was 15, I started my own photography business, which was kind of funny because my clients had to pick me up to go do a photo shoot because I didn't have my driver's license yet. And so entrepreneurial kind of endeavors have like always been in my DNA. For wine, kind of like my, you know, starting story in wine, if you will, really started from the day I was legally allowed to drink wine. I got into wine very young, but then kind of went on this journey of learning a lot more about wine. That all got heightened when I actually went and backpacked through Europe for 3 months. And you're just spending like so much time on planes, trains, and buses that I ended up listening to a lot of podcasts about wine. And something that was really incredible for me was like, you know, I made sure to listen to a podcast about Spain and Spanish wine before going to Spain. And then listening to, you know, podcast about Italian wine before going to Italy. And by the time I got to Italy, I kind of had enough confidence in my wine knowledge to start, I feel like, using it a little bit more. And so I have this really distinct memory, which I always like think back to as still one of the like major motivating reasons that I love wine today, which is that I remember walking into this really small wine shop in Tuscany. And like, you know, we'd been drinking so much red wine, because of course, and in that region, that's what you drink. But my husband was like, you know, it'd be really great if we had some white wine. And I was like, okay, well, we should just get some Vernaccia di San Gimignano. And I remember walking into the wine shop and like asking for that. And the wine shop owner was just like, you know, flabbergasted. She was like, I can't believe that you like know what that is, ask for it. She, you know, shakes me back to the back corner because it's really not what, you know, a young American walking into a wine shop is typically asking for. And that ended up opening up a whole, like when we spoke for like over an hour about just like her family and her heritage and like the fact that I could connect with, you know, knowing a little bit about, you know, her region and how her, like, you know, it was one of her family's favorite wines that we ended up buying, and just the connection that came out of the fact that I knew a little bit. That for me has been actually my major motivating kind of thread for wine and for really my entire career in wine. And I always think back to that story. So, yeah.
That's a very heartwarming story. And so it really wasn't just by luck. It seems to have been destined for you, fate, you know, when you sort of traveled all along the well trodden parts of Europe. And I'm sure you drank copious amounts of wine during that journey of yours. Now, I think it's our gain in the wine world, and that's that we have you. Now, you also have this moniker, you know, the wine nerd. You know, so there's wine base and wine nerd. Tell us about, you know, the wine nerd.
Yeah. So the wine nerd, which I guess is kind of my, it was like a pseudonym for a blog slash a bunch of projects that I just ended up doing and getting to collaborate on. But how it started was I was at Facebook as my day job and really loving, you know, getting to be connected into the wine industry and I'm going, you know, probably to wine country or doing a wine thing every weekend. So there's like so much access and having a lot of fun. And what I started to realize was that, you know, I kind of, from my role in data science, have the skill set of taking data, synthesizing it, telling a story and being able to like visually communicate that to people. And what I thought about was, well, there's not really that much of that in wine. I really look up to Madeline Puckett, who's amazing with Wine Folly. And what I was thinking about was like, how could I do this for some of the things that I'm curious about and some of the projects that I want to work on and use, you know, really like data to go in and drive that. And so I started an Instagram account where I would create these graphics. And I thought, if I can make things that are interesting enough for people to follow me on Instagram, which is just graphs, then like I must be doing something right. And I ended up doing a bunch of projects that were just so inspiring and fulfilling. I mean, some of my favorites were I got to work with the Lyft Collective on, you know, one of the, I think it was one of the first, if not the first, and it's kind of hard to tell, but a gender study about wine. So asking people just how they view kind of their career, equality, pay transparency, and all focused around gender and the impact that that has. I got to work on a canned wine study with Maker Wine. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but down in Stanford, talking about like the perception of canned wine. And it ended up just being this amazing kind of couple years of working on a little bit of a hodgepodge of projects, but getting to meet and be connected into the wine world. Because at that point, like I was still in my day job and, you know, really at night being the wine nerd and being just so, so eager to like learn more and contribute and support. And so that really was like the biggest unlock for me, learning about the problems that we're solving with Vinebase today and learning about, you know, where I see the opportunity for independent winemakers and wineries and kind of, you know, the next wave of how people are buying wine. That ended up being like the wine nerd ended up really being kind of the entry point for that.
Right. Now, just before we move on to the Vinebase, you mentioned the study on canned wine.
Yes.
For those that haven't had the opportunity to see that study of yours, I think it's certainly from my perspective and what I'm seeing on the market and my research, it's increasing. And mm-hmm. and it's actually starting to really balloon out. What did your studies indicate, Rachel?
Yeah. So we did a couple of different things. We did a survey of a bunch of wine drinkers to understand kind of like the knowledge gap when it comes to canned wine. I think that's a really big piece that I've been happy to see, you know, canned wine companies like Maker overcoming, right? Around a lot of people didn't know that those kind of like soda can sized cans of wine, that's half a bottle. And so when you're looking at the price of that size of can, like it's half a bottle that you're buying. It's like the price, you know, reflects that versus then a slightly smaller can, you know, it's a little bit smaller proportion, can be smaller price. So there's a lot of interesting things around like kind of the consumer knowledge gap or just what you know, needed to be explained better. But then my favorite part was we actually set up a blind tasting at Stanford. And we found the exact same wines, the exact mm-hmm. same, you know, juice. We found them in bottles and cans.
Okay.
And we did this study where we poured, you know, we poured the wine out into kind of like blind containers. People didn't know if it was a can or a bottle. And then we had people taste and we said, you know, like, what do you think of the wine? And then do you think it's from a can or a bottle? Because mm-hmm. like our kind of hypothesis and the thing that we heard a lot was like people thought that a can imparts quote unquote can flavors on the wine. And we were like, okay, well, let's just see how true that sure. is. What we found was there's no statistically significant difference in what people liked between the can, whether that wine originally came from a can or a bottle. But interestingly enough, the wines that they rated lower they thought came from cans. And so it really kind of showed that, again, like knowledge gap. And for me, like with a little bit of the marketing background I have, like that was such an exciting outcome because it's like, oh, this is just a marketing challenge. And, you know, one of like helping people understand, you know, why there's not a quote can flavor on the wines. But it was a really fun study. And I really loved getting to like work with Maker. They're some of my favorite canned wines still to date. I don't know if you've had them.
Tell me. No, I haven't had the pleasure. I just wanted to ask you, what's the perception that, did you do anything on the perception of canned wines? Were they favorable? No major difference or unfavorable?
Yeah. It really depended. Like there was a lot of variance, you know, and also like we published the study on both Maker Wines and also the Wine Nerd. I still have that kind of site up. And so there's the full like breakdown of the report from that. But I think what was really like fascinating was just kind of seeing what everybody knew in the market in right. terms of, you know,
awareness,
mm-hmm. awareness was really lacking.
Well, that's very interesting. And I'm sure in the years to come, we'll see more and more of that type of, you know, methodology to put wine into, as opposed to the bottles that we become so accustomed to. Now, Rachel, Vinebase is a public benefit corporation. Can you tell us what that means, you know, for those that are not familiar with that term?
Yeah. So first, I should probably kind of take a step back and share a little bit too about what Vinebase is.
Yes.
So really, our goal is to empower independent wineries and help them thrive. You know, we really kind of through my time as the wine nerd, and then also just seeing, especially the pandemic, the impact that it had on small independent wineries, especially here in the US, but really it was all over the world. There's just so much about how wine is typically bought and sold today that just, you know, really doesn't work for the independent small producer. You know, you have to get wine through the three-tier system, which we can talk more about. You have to figure out how to like market and differentiate. There's just all this complexity. And so when we started the company, really our goal was to create a better world and a better future for these independent winemakers.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, I don't know if familiar are with public benefit corporations. I don't know if you've come across them.
I don't know if before. It's a public benefit. Is it similar to like a nonprofit organization?
It's a little different. So we're still a for-profit corporation. We're just hold to two types of shareholders. So normally with a for-profit corporation, you're tied to your economic shareholders. With a public mm-hmm. benefit corporation, you're tied to them as well as like the public benefit as the shareholder. And so what it means is you can prioritize both impact on the world and, you know, building a company that's going to grow and be sustainable. It is different than, you know, nonprofit. You know, we are still a for-profit company, but it's something that I'm seeing, you know, even in this house I mentioned earlier of all the other companies, there's more and more companies that are starting up really with this in their DNA of like, you know, we want to be a company, we want to have an impact, we want to grow a business, but we also want to leave the world better off than when we started.
Which is very laudable. Now, just a quick question. So the public benefit corporation, you have private shareholders, and then you allocate certain shares for the public, like which you administer for their benefit?
So it's not specifically around the shares. It's just more about kind of decision-making authority and who you're held accountable to. And what, you know, there's a couple of really, you know, large successful public benefit corporations. It is a newer type business model, but one I think of is Kickstarter pretty often. So okay. Kickstarter, I don't know if you're familiar with Kickstarter.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, so they're a for-profit corporation. You know, they're doing really well. They're a sustainable business, but their goal in the world is not only to be a business, but also to make the world better. So they're able to make decisions that align with both.
And we're totally supportive of that. Now, now you mentioned earlier on something about the three-tier system. And my question to you was, what are the main obstacles you have seen and continue to see that wineries have, like the three-tier system, the tied house laws? And what do you suggest to them, you know, when you say, look, we'll look after you, you know, we will be of service to you?
Yeah. So, I mean, the three-tier system itself, I think it's really important to like start kind of, you know, any statement about it by saying it's not bad, right? Like there are a lot of wineries and a lot of retailers and then distributors as well that benefit from it and have created, you know, their own sustaining businesses out of it. Mm-hmm. I think what's really challenging is when you're a small, you know, a small winery, a small business, you're making a small quantity of wine, to get it through a layer of middlemen who have, you know, oftentimes like binders and books and books and books and lists and lists and lists of producers and SKUs to go out and sell to restaurants and retailers. That's just really challenging for like small produced, small batch wine to get through.
So maybe you could just explain what the three-tier system is for our audience.
Yes. Yeah, I would love to. So in the US, winery or any supplier, you know, brewery or a distillery, they have to sell to a distributor first, and then that distributor is able to turn around and sell to a restaurant or retailer. There are some states in which you're able to kind of, as a winery, go directly to the restaurant or retailer, but for the most part, in most states, you're required to sell to a distributor who then kind of controls that relationship. And the reason why those laws are in place was literally 100-year-old laws from Prohibition era time. And, you know, as a side note, like I had the privilege of going to the National Conference for State Liquor Administrators last year, which is kind of the aggregation of all of the ABCs and a lot of the people who are thinking about alcohol regulation. And you even just hear that the essence of why the three-tier system was created was a lot around like temperance and making sure there was control around how alcohol moved through the market. And a lot of that isn't as applicable today. You as a winery are able to see, you know, move through the three-tier system, or you're actually able to sell directly to the end consumer. You're able to, you know, not even need to go through restaurants, retailers, or distributors, just really build that direct relationship yourself. The challenge with that model is the kind of dominant way that wineries have been able to, you know, build out their direct to consumer business is through the tasting room. So it requires people to, you know, fly to wine country, have a fun weekend, sign up for the wine club, and then go home. And that's just been also really challenging for wineries to get, you know, growing at the rate to be able to create a sustainable business. And so what you have kind of in the world of small independent wine today, it's basically a bunch of wineries, and really it's the majority of wineries. When you look at the number of wineries in the US, not necessarily production volume, but majority of wineries who, you know, they're really trying to figure out how to build a sustainable, you know, business that they can grow and have the access and resources to go and do that. The problem is they're lacking the skills to go do that. They love making wine, you know,
they can make the wine, but they can't get it out to the market. That's the issue.
Exactly. And you kind of just this like system that just doesn't really work for them. Okay. So you
Just before we move on, we had the tied house laws as well. So perhaps if you could just explain that.
Yeah. So tied house laws are a fun one. If you Google tied house laws, you don't get much. And that's because it's kind of still, I think it's a pretty like hand wavy in how it's applied and enforced. But the essence of it is that a supplier should not have favoritism and directly work with any retailer or restaurant, that third tier. And so what happens then as well is like, as a winery, you not only have to sell to the distributor, you can't even really talk to or build a relationship with the retailer who's actually at the end of the line selling your wine. One part that's really great about what we're doing with Vine Base in our model, and we were really intentional from the start, is that we're not a retailer. Wineries are really just setting up their own mini shops, their mini stores in our platform. And whenever a consumer goes through and buys wine through the platform, they're placing a direct order with that winery. And so all we are is a, you know, third party software provider, a marketing platform, if you will. Meaning that we're really like helping the winery just build that connect relationship with the end customer. And we don't have the challenges of the three-tier system and the tied house laws kind of, you know, holding back anything that wineries want to do.
So you're a very vital and appears to be a very essential part for the growth and the selling of wines for the smaller producer. So this is the winery, and they come in and then they connect with Vinebase. They use your platform, and the consumer comes to Vinebase and says, okay, I like this, buy this, buy this. Order goes through, and bang, the winery takes care of that.
Yes. Yeah.
Wonderful. I mean, I think it serves many purposes and efficient. So certainly a number of small scale wineries, I mean, some I see are producing like 300, 400, 500 cases. They wouldn't have the capacity to engage in any large scale marketing with that because it's a very low volume.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I think that certainly illustrates the marketplace out there. Now, is that why you decided to focus on small wineries? Because what I found very interesting was that your small wineries have very specific subcategories, which are quite marvelous, like woman-led, vegan-friendly, minority-led, organic and biodynamic. Was that a decision that you made, a concerted sort of effort? Or did it just happen that a number of these wineries were part of those subcategories?
Yeah, I love the question. And it's definitely been concerted, but I think in maybe a different way than people might think, which is that, you know, when you kind of meet a small winery, independent winery, you learn a lot more about their story. And, you know, more often than not, the reason why someone started a winery in the first place is they love making wine. They're obviously passionate about their craft, but they have something else there as well in their story that motivates them.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, you have, you know, consumers who, especially in today's way that people care about finding companies and businesses that they want to support, products they want to buy, they really care about knowing that why and knowing that mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we created our tagging system, which is what you're referring to, where we have the tags of women-led wineries, you know, vegan friendly, sustainable, what we wanted to do was kind of merge those two desires. The fact that a winery has this amazing story, they have, you know, their why, they have what makes them different, you know, what makes them unique. And then you have on the other side, the consumer that really wants to know that information. The thing that makes us really excited is that whenever you think about going and buying wine in like the grocery store shelf or retail shelf or anywhere in person, usually, you know, it's only organized by one way. It's like, you know, it's impossible to organize a shelf in, you know, 100 different ways. Like it has to be usually
it's
organized.
Countries and varieties.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And versus whenever you're able to shop, you know, on our platform, but really broadly like online for wine, you can have that shelf organized however you want, right? And it can be really related to what you care about and how you want to spend your money and how you want to support. And so that gets us really excited about kind of our tags and the wineries that we help tell their stories.
Love the tags, Rachel. Love the
Thank
tags.
Thank you. Thank you.
So now tell me, you know, I could you share with us, you know, how do you define vegan-friendly wine?
Yes. So the other part about the tags is that it's all winery controlled. Also all, you know, user generated, the wineries themselves actually control all of the content on the site. And so, so they have their whole like backend portal. They're adding their wines, they're adding their stories. And so today we don't set any really controls on the tags themselves. Instead, we take an approach of we want to empower winery to tell their story in the way that they want. And so what has been interesting about vegan friendly is there's a lot more wine on Vinebase that's vegan friendly than what's tagged as such. And I think that's reflective of like a lot of wineries, you know, they lean into certain parts of their why, certain parts of their process, and that's what they want to be known for. So, you know, we don't necessarily define vegan wine and define like with some set standards. I think it's pretty obvious though to people what vegan wine is, right? Do you use any animal byproducts in the winemaking process? If someone is vegan sitting in front of you, are you going to tell them that your wine is vegan? You know, like it's kind of that, you know, more.
So basically they don't use egg white when it comes to the fining, filtration and.
Exactly.
Ice and glass, you know, fish bladder. Understood. Understood.
Yeah.
Right. Now, you know, we spoke about the wineries being responsible for the shipping. So this compliance issue between, you know, state to state, it's not much of a problem, or is it a problem when it comes to shipping for your clients?
So it's definitely a challenge in the industry overall. There's kind of this joke I heard at that conference I mentioned, which was the US, there's 50 states and 51 set of alcohol laws that you have to learn and know. And I wish that was untrue, but it is actually quite true. Our kind of like, you know, our view on that, or the opportunity rather, is like the way wineries have had to approach that historically has been like, they have to learn all 51 sets of laws. It's much better when you have kind of either a platform or partners or resources that really help guide and make it easier to go and like follow those, learn them, get those questions answered, et cetera. And so what we've done with our product is on the back end, like I just mentioned, we have a really easy way for wineries to not only set up what needs to be set up for the way that they sell and ship, but also be able to like link out to, you know, we love the Wine Institute, has amazing resources on shipping laws. And mm-hmm. so we have those really easy links out to help a winery go in and learn what they need to be doing. And on the consumer side, one of our favorite features is we actually only show the wines that can ship to you. I don't know if you've seen that because you're not in the US, so you might have gotten the like, sorry, none of the wines can ship to you page.
Yeah, but I just chose the state, and that's true.
You've seen it. Yeah. But that's one of the things too, where it's like, you know, when you buy wine online, it's such a bummer when you get to the checkout and that wine can't be shipped to you, right? Like, yeah. How do you, you know, something we thought about is like, how do you prevent that? Because that's just not a fun experience.
Yeah, I think we have perhaps not as stringent a law as what you have in the United States, but certainly in Canada, we have monopolies. You know,
right.
So the government is the monopoly when it comes to the aspect of selling wine, very restrictive of how many private liquor stores they allow and what distance and when. And so in another way, it's also a method of controlling. And I guess there is a logic behind that. Now, talking about vine base, I mean, it certainly has its niche. It certainly is, and I'm glad to hear that it's growing. But like in life, anything good always has more than one competitor, and there are many. Who are your main competitors, and why should they select you for their platform and service as opposed to others, Rachel?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think the way that we think about competition or competitive landscape is actually quite broad, which is mm-hmm. that really there are so many ways to buy and sell wine, and all mm-hmm. of those are in the kind of competitive landscape to think about. Our kind of challenge to ourselves is like, how do we become the best, right? How do we be the most sustainable for the producer? How do we help tell the story the best? How do we empower the people who are using the platform the best? And that's really like kind of how we think about, our niche and how our niche stacks up against all the other ways that you can buy and sell wine. There are a lot of other awesome ways to buy and sell wine. You know, if you want a flash deal, there's a lot of great sites for that. If you want something just down the street, there's a lot of great places to go buy that. But for us, we're really focused on how do we build that sustainable future for the winemaker, that connection between, you know, the consumer and the story behind the bottle.
The sense I get is you see yourself as an extension of the marketing arm of wineries. And with that, not only is it just an extension, but there's a sort of beating heart. And, you know, with the public benefit corporation, you're building this sort of symbiotic relationship, which you'd like to see continue for years to come. So I congratulate you on that, Rachel. It's lovely.
Thank you.
I think it's unique, and I love the way that your tags come along.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so we'll be watching you very eagerly and with interest. Now, coming to you, Rachel, you know, you've traveled Europe, you went on a backpack, and I'm sure you've tried so many different wines in your experience. But what's a perfect pairing of food and wine for you?
Yeah, well, I'm really glad you didn't ask what's your favorite wine, because I feel like everybody who's really into wine, drinks a lot of wine, like kind of hates that question, because then you're like,
I'm always asked.
I don't know. Like, it's like picking a favorite child, you know? Yeah. But so one definitely comes to mind, because I've started kind of a trend with my friends where we do like a really nice rack of lamb and a Northern Rhone Syrah. And that to me is just magic. Like, that meal I could have all the time. In fact, I'm continuously having it all the time. it's pretty incredible. I'm curious what yours is. I don't know how often people throw the question back at you.
That's true. They always do. And if it's a perfect pairing of food and wine, it really depends on the guests and who I'm eating it with. Because I think, you know, we should be inclusive of whoever we're sharing the meal with, certainly if it's an Asian style meal. But if it's, you know, an individual plating, certainly what you've mentioned is very high on the list. It just has that voluptuous body of that rack of lamb, and the Syrah just blends in, you know, sort of so intricately, yet it gives off so many different flavors. You know, it's sort of like a pirouette from a world-class ballerina. Never ends, just keeps on giving and giving. So
yes,
that's really true. So Rachel, you are truly one of the sort of, I would say, a catalyst within this wine industry that is making changes, huge changes. Where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? Where would you like to see yourself?
Well, I would love to live in a world where buying independent wine is the norm. I mean, I feel like it might be a little bit of a like cop out to just talk about like the, you know, the mission of the company, but it really is what we want to do. I think the thing that gets me just so stoked every morning is seeing the progress towards that. We're really moving towards a world in so many things. There's so many projects going on. It's not just Finebase that's thinking about this problem and working on it. There's a lot of collaborative efforts that are really pushing forward a more equal wine world. I think the thing that I hope is as true in 10 years, and I fully expect it to be as it is today, is just being so continuously inspired by the day to day. You know, I'm really inspired by my team, the people I get to work with every day on this problem, our customers who I get to hang out with, talk about product with, they get feedback, and really just the broader industry. I mean, it's such a fun, I don't need to tell you this, like it's just such a fun group of people and inspiring people to be with all the time. Is, you know, there's so much passion in wine, and I think that's certainly one of the best parts.
Whenever I am lecturing to students who are taking their very first step into the world of wine, I always say to them, you are about to embark into an industry where you will meet, for the most part, the most wonderful, generous, warm-hearted, and very giving type of people. These are not cutthroat people. These are people who really appreciate what they do. And you will see that within their entire character. And Rachel, you are part of that esteemed group. It's Aww. been a huge pleasure having this opportunity to interview you. And thank you so much for sharing your insights into the wine world with us.
You've been listening to Wine Buzz Podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please leave a review or share it with a friend. Apwazi is an online wine and spirit institution dedicated to promoting culture and diversity through the world of education. If you're looking to get started, we have a free online course that we are giving out to all our listeners. For more information, head to apwazi.com. That's APWASI.com.